and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, September 4th, 2018. A South Sudanese aid worker is killed in the line of duty in Yeyu River State.
After the Mukaya Junction, they were just driving, then suddenly bullets were spread at the car. There was no warning, they didn't see anybody, they just saw bullets coming in. And his colleague, the nutrition officer, cried out. And the driver realized that he was shot.
And South Sudanese refugees meet leaders of the warring parties in Khartoum.
Without peace, these people, they cannot move out from the camps. And to assure that they are going to have safety or for the protection of their life, we need to get assurance for them from our leader. Who signed the draft? Who signed the agreement?
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Aid workers are condemning the killing of an employee of a Christian humanitarian organization over the weekend. The executive director of Across says one of his employees was killed while traveling from Lanya to Yei. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
Across executive director Elisa Mawani says Joseph Kiri, a South Sudanese national, was shot dead at close range near Limbe along the Lanya Yei Road on Sunday. When he says the nutrition officer was working on a monthly activity report for the organization's main office in Yei when he and the driver were attacked by unidentified gunmen.
Just after leaving Limbe, like about less than a mile after Limbe, after the Mukaya Junction, they were just driving, then suddenly bullets were spread at the car. There was no warning, they didn't see anybody, they just saw bullets coming in, and his colleague, the nutrition officer, cried out, and the driver realized that he was shot. So he tried to help, but there was no way, so he just untied himself from the seatbelt and jumped out, and the car continued. He jumped, ran through the bush up to Limbe, and from there he reported, and of course the soldiers in Limbe had the shooting, so they went in and found our colleague, the nutrition officer Joseph Kiri, was shot.
SPLA IO spokesman Colonel Lam Gabriel told VOA yesterday that opposition forces controlled the area of Kupera in Yei River State, where he says rebel forces were attacked by government forces.
Because Kupera is a big area for us under our control, and there were civilians who were there who already settled. So the attack in Kupera displaced several civilians.
According to research by Humanitarian Outcomes in its 2018 Aid Worker Security Report released last month, South Sudan was ranked the worst place to be an aid worker, a dubious distinction it has held for 3 years in a row. Since the conflict began, more than 100 aid workers have been killed in South Sudan. When he says since the beginning of this year, Across has lost 4 staff members in the line of duty. He says in each case, aid workers were traveling in vehicles clearly marked with the Across logo.
The car had NGO number plate, it has a logo of Across, and it has an Across flag, and yet it was shot at. So all those things were there. You know, in the field, we use the flag, and the Across flag is white, and the logo of Across is almost like a cross. You know, we are a Christian organization. And on the side, you can see a big logo of Across. It was evident. Yeah. But whatever happened, we don't know. But we are asking those who did it to really repent and ask God to forgive them and change their ways.
When he says the rest of his staff is devastated by this latest attack.
The family is in tears. All of us are very, very devastated with what has happened. We feel this is time when we should all be talking about peace, not killing. We cannot afford to lose any precious life in South Sudan anymore. And so this is really a tragic thing. And our appeal is to whoever did it, please spare the lives of your people. Too many of us have died, and we cannot die anymore.
When he says Joseph Kiri's body was flown from Yei to Juba yesterday and is at a UN-run mortuary. His family plans to bury him tomorrow. The deceased was also an evangelist and worked as the Episcopal Church of South Sudan Provincial Youth Coordinator in Lanya County. Juba-based iRadio quotes John Lumori, the Secretary General for the Episcopal Church, as describing Kiri as an active and dedicated church youth leader. Christina Corbett, a spokesperson at the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, declined to comment on this story, saying her office would issue a statement about attacks on aid workers at a later time. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Representatives of South Sudanese refugees in Uganda, Kenya, the Central African Republic, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Sudan are meeting with the parties negotiating to end the conflict in South Sudan. The UN Refugee Agency, which transported the 18 representatives, say it hopes the dialogue will help allow refugees play a key role in restoring peace in South Sudan. Michael Atit has the story for VOA from Khartoum.
The refugee representatives are asking the parties at the talks to guarantee that refugees and internally displaced persons will be free to return home safely once a final peace agreement is signed. At a one-day workshop organized in Sudanese capital Khartoum, some refugees said they are willing to return home but want assurance from South Sudan's leaders that they will provide security and will return to the country at peace. 50-year-old Margaret Wani Ambe of Yei fled to Sudan more than 4 years ago when conflict first erupted in South Sudan in late 2013. She says she's tired of living in a foreign country where, she says, life has no meaning.
Staying in a foreign country or in another country is not easy, but your own country is better. Even if you stay under the tree, you will feel comfortable because you know you can just cultivate a small land, you can eat freely. You will not look at things all in the market, in the town. All things are in the market with money.
Wani says South Sudanese refugees are frustrated with their lifestyle, which she says has been forced on them by the political leaders. She says South Sudanese women in Khartoum cannot continue working in Sudanese houses for living, and she wants guarantee from political leaders that she and her family will be safe when they return home.
And you find a number of women who are not taking the responsibility of their families because they just go in their houses, washing plates, cleaning, and they're doing this handwork which can bring in an income that can push them. But otherwise, life is difficult.
23-year-old Yach Por, a refugee living in Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, says South Sudanese need genuine peace that would allow them to go home and start rebuilding their country. Without peace, he says, no one will go back home.
Without peace, these people, they cannot move out from the camps. And to assure that they are going to have safety or for the protection of their life, we need to get assurance for them from our leader. Who signed the draft? Who signed the agreement?
Both Wani and Paul says South Sudan's leaders must provide returning refugees and IDPs with basic services, including healthcare and education. Alnod Adujenu, an advisor to UN High Commissioner for Refugees in South Sudan, says the agency intends to involve refugees in implementing the peace deal, noting they have borne the brunt of the conflict and need to be part of the peace implementation process.
They will be fully part of the process. Place seat will be given to them to look into the implementation process, to see how that can affect the future, what they can expect from that. It's a good starting point.
Adojeno says the parties at the talks have assured him they will fully implement the peace agreement so refugees can return home. Chapter 3 of the River Talais Peace Agreement requires the parties to safely repatriate refugees and IDPs to their homes. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
Women empowerment is a common theme on the road to developing South Sudan, but researchers have wondered how to measure women and girls' empowerment. The Washington-based Center for Global Development and its partners are looking into ways to offer what they call a comprehensive process, which could help researchers develop strategies for measuring empowerment tools that work. Ayen Deng-Bior has details from Washington.
Figuring out just how empowered women and girls are in any given country can be tricky, according to Rachel Glanister, chief economist at the UK's Department for International Development. But empowerment can be quantified, even if measuring it is difficult. The Center for Global Development and its partners came up with a resource guide to help researchers in the field avoid some reoccurring issues and unintended consequences when collecting data. A major issue, according to Glenister, is receiving genuine answers from interviewees.
The area that I think has been under-discussed in a lot of the literature about measuring women's empowerment is the problem of social desirability bias and reporting bias. And this is just fundamental to all the work we do. You want to hear from women, you want to hear the voice of women, you want to understand what they care about, but you've also got to worry about the fact that what they say to you is very much influenced by what they think you want to hear. And that's just fun. It's just a huge problem in this area.
One way to mitigate reporting bias is to frame the question indirectly by asking about a hypothetical situation, according to the resource guide published in partnership with the Abdul Latif Jamil Poverty Action Lab. It also suggests that researchers use non-survey instruments like a game or direct observation, which can be less susceptible to reporting bias. Glenister says it's not just about getting an outcome that other people might want. She says researchers should look at the broader picture.
If you just say, well, if women are earning more, that's a good thing. For who? Like, it's not necessarily a good thing for the women. And what we care about is, you know, and I say this in many contexts, we don't care about empowerment because it produces more income. We care about income because it produces more empowerment. I mean, it's about or more, you know, life well-being. Like, that's the objective of everything that we do is, you know, is improving people's lives, not improving people's incomes.
João Montalvão, a World Bank economist at the Africa Gender Innovation Lab, points out some other issues while gathering such data, as well as possible solutions to avoiding potential pitfalls.
In order to measure empowerment, it's my personal view perhaps, but it's not one question or a set of indicators or an index. It's actually a measurement system. So you map out this theory of change where you relax constraints here, and then you have several pathways that will lead to your ultimate desired outcomes. Growing business, welfare impacts, whatever it is. And then you need to build indicators throughout these entire causal paths. And empowerment would be a change, a systematic change throughout this entire system.
Empowerment itself is a complex issue, but the report's authors point out that factual data on whether women lack power to make choices could help identify new ways to help them make important decisions in the future and reduce gender inequality. Ayan Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, how do you fight the fall armyworm without using pesticides? We'll bring answers to that question right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
can you get just as good a university education in your home country as you would abroad?
Yes, I can get a good university, number one. I can give an example in Uganda. We have Makerere University. It's a good university. So if it's a good university, it can give us whatever we can. Best ranked, I think, in Africa.
I believe that the schools out there are better, maybe because the countries are much more developed and they do a lot of specialization than the schools or institutions we have this week.
Yeah, I think that you can get the best and quality education from your home university or from your country. But basing on other countries' development or level of study, you can go for further specialization, but after you come back to invest in your country.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday Health segment. And today, we are talking about sustainable ways to fight the armyworm. Fall armyworms are on the march across Africa. Agriculture experts say the pest could cause more than 13 billion in crop losses this year. Scientists are researching pesticides, landscape management methods, and genetically modified crops to stop the fall armyworm from destroying crops. Faith Lopidus reports on an effort to find a sustainable approach that does not use pesticides.
The caterpillar is feeding.
The fall armyworm has already caused billions of dollars worth of crop losses in Africa and could cause billions more if not stopped. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization and Uganda's Ministry of Agriculture says a new mobile application will help to eradicate the pest.
We must emphasize that is a community monitoring and early warning tool, because the farmer himself must be enabled to do detection and decision-making that is equipped with information available to him.
Farmers enter data that the app then uses to calculate infestation levels for appropriate action. Introduced in Madagascar and Zambia, the app is being rolled out across all of sub-Saharan Africa, where the fall armyworm has been found.
When the fall armyworm broke out, it took me a while to recognize it. By the time I knew it was the maize-destroying worm, my whole garden had been ruined. But from what I've learned here today and the trap we've been given to use, I hope to save crops compared to losing them as before.
Stephen Biantwale Tibejuka is Uganda's commissioner for crop protection.
There are other residual populations that are in other areas feasting on other crops that are fresh are growing. So this is the warning we were talking about, that having a garden of maize that is mature and you are not seeing fall armyworm does not mean the fall armyworm is not there.
The data farmers collect on the fall armyworm goes to a global web-based platform for analysis on ways to one day exterminate the invasive pest. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Mukono, Uganda.
That story was rather by Halima Athmani from Kampala. We now turn to Malawi, where the low maize harvest means nearly a quarter of the country's population is expected to face food shortages this year. The Minister of Agriculture's final survey of national crop production released this month shows a 20% decrease in maize production compared to last year. Governments say the response plans are underway to find a solution.
The Minister of Agriculture survey estimates this year's maize crop at 2.6 million tons compared to last year's 3.4 million tons. That's a 20% decline compared to the 5-year average. The survey says rice, millet, and wheat crops are also down. 4 armyworms hit 20 of the 28 districts in Malawi during the last growing season. President Peter Mutharika declared a state of disaster in the affected districts. In addition, the Minister of Agriculture figures show that drought has affected more than 800,000 households. The Malawi Vulnerability Assessment Report says 3.5 million people will be food insecure this year. Osborne Tsoka is the spokesperson for the Minister of Agriculture. Tsoka says plans are underway to mitigate the impact.
Definitely a response plan will be developed. From the agriculture side, we'll be looking at the increase in production, more especially on the areas that are irrigable, just to improve on the availability of food.
Mitek Mai, the acting country director of World Food Programme in Malawi, says the agency is finalizing its own analysis to determine the number of people who may require assistance for the next lean season. He says the agency is already reaching more than 723,000 people in 10 shock-prone and food-insecure districts in Malawi. Alfred Kavichira Banda is the president of Farmers Union of Malawi. He says food shortages can only be averted if farmers are encouraged to grow drought-resistant crops like potatoes and cassava.
Farmers are not interested in growing more crops because even if they grow more, they don't have a market to sell. So the major things they are doing these days is that they grow a crop for themselves only. So there's no way a country can have a bumper yield.
The government plans to soon start an agriculture commercialization project to provide revolving loans to large hold farmers to help them boost production. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
From Blantyre, we move to China, where the China-Africa Summit wrapped up in Beijing today, with China pledging to extend new funding of $60 billion to Africa, aimed at areas from industrial enhancement to infrastructure. China said it will wipe clean the debt for certain African countries when interest-free loans come due later this year. No details were provided. China's President Xi Jinping said during the next 3 years and beyond, China would carry out 8 major initiatives with the African countries, including infrastructure, connectivity, healthcare, and peace and security. VOA's Beijing correspondent Bill Aid describes the summit's highlights to my colleague Kim Lewis.
Well, one of the biggest highlights, of course, was the $60 billion in loans that China has announced that it's going to extend to Africa. And this is on top of the $60 billion that was announced at the last forum on China-Africa cooperation. China also said that it would absolve debt that certain countries owe for interest-free loans that's coming to term at the end of the year. China has not said specifically which countries would be helping out in this way. It just said that these are poor countries that are landlocked. Some of them are islands that support it diplomatically. It kind of gave a very vague hint at, you know, which countries this might possibly be referring to. But we just had a press conference at the end of the forum, and there was no real more details that were given on those loans and absolving of loans. It also said that there's no political strings attached to the loans that it's extending. Obviously, that's something that is hotly debated, of course, but that's China's position, that it's not offering or extending these loans with political strings.
And I know we touched on this a little bit yesterday as well, but going back to the African leaders and the business people of Africa, what are they saying about this issue?
We've heard a lot of support from people that are here. Most of those business representatives and leaders have been kept far away from media. We've been able to go to hotels and speak with some of the delegates and representatives who are here. And, you know, one of the key messages that we're hearing from them is that we're looking for opportunities to boost business, to get investment. It's something that's very exciting for them because, as they say, there are not other countries in the world that are doing what China is doing in Africa. Actually, we had a chance to speak to someone who is a presidential aide to one of the countries attending, and that representative was saying that, you know, look, China does what nobody else does. It comes in and it has plans already that it offers up to us and says, look, we can do this and this is how we're going to do it. What other choice do we have but to accept? Obviously, this has been an opportunity for China to kind of champion its efforts and to show how it's doing something that nobody else in the world is doing. But it's also using the meeting to kind of advance its own initiatives like the Belt and Road Initiative. And that was one thing that Xi Jinping said in the press conference that just concluded not too long ago. He was talking about how the Belt and Road Initiative, this $1 trillion trade and infrastructure initiative that China is pushing to kind of link countries around the globe, how that links up with the African Union's 2063 agenda and also the UN's 2030, a goal for sustainable development.
Just looking at the fact that Africa's trade with China has continued to increase over the years, while trade with the U.S. and Europe has been pretty stagnant. So why is it that China is the leader there right now in Africa?
Well, it's got deeper pockets. It really leads in infrastructure. It's very well positioned to kind of take on those kinds of projects. Obviously, there's a lot of controversy in the way that China carries out the projects and bringing its own workers over. But China is strategically, this is kind of the way it operates.
That's VOA's correspondent Bill Eads in Beijing speaking with my colleague Kim Lewis. In the United States, it's often said that no one is above the law, even the President of the United States. But what happens when the President is implicated in criminal wrongdoing? The question took on a new relevance last month after President Donald Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, pleaded guilty to violating campaign finance laws, which he says was done at the direction of the then-candidate Trump. Historically, dealing with possible criminal activity in the Oval Office has often been a mix of legal and political approach, as we hear from VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone.
In front of excited supporters in West Virginia, President Trump ignored his legal difficulties and rallied his base.
Under our administration, America is winning again, and America is being respected again all over the world. It's America first.
But the guilty plea from former attorney Michael Cohen and the fraud conviction of former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort have handed opposition Democrats a new political weapon just in time for the November congressional election campaign. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer.
If my Republican colleagues remain silent, the party is becoming a co-conspirator in the culture of corruption that surrounds this president.
Thank you, everybody, very much.
Trump's possible involvement in the campaign violations admitted to by Cohen could put the president in legal jeopardy, says expert Paul Schiff Berman.
He is potentially now an unindicted co-conspirator and could be indicted. Now, there is an open question as to whether a sitting president can be indicted for criminal wrongdoing. Obviously, he could be impeached, but that's not going to happen as long as Republicans hold the House and the Senate.
A criminal indictment of the president is unlikely, says analyst Eric Tucker.
The Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, the OLC, has said in a couple of opinions that it does not believe that a sitting president while in office can be indicted. And we are told by lawyers for the president that Special Counsel Mueller's team intends to adhere to that guidance.
Under the U.S. Constitution, a president may be impeached by Congress and removed from office for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. In 1998, President Bill Clinton was impeached for lying about an affair with intern Monica Lewinsky.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky.
Clinton survived an impeachment trial in the Senate, but there was a different outcome for President Richard Nixon in 1974.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
Nixon left office after Congress began impeachment proceedings over the Watergate scandal. History has shown that when it comes to dealing with presidential wrongdoing, there's often a balance between legal and political remedies, says legal expert Sai Krishna Prakash.
The fact that he might not be able to be prosecuted while president might cause some people to think that the president is above the law. But of course, you know, when you're designing a system, you have to decide, do you want to subject the president to possible prosecution while he's president?
Ultimately, if President Trump is accused of any criminal wrongdoing, his fate is likely to be decided by Congress and the public, not a judge and jury. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
The King. That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song A Call by Congolese music star Fally Ipupa. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad to have you with us. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Gorbi le Valois.